Hi, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Bitcoin Bottom Line. I'm CJ Wilson, and today's guest is Mike Hobart. Mike is a veteran, and he is also a contributor to Bitcoin Magazine. Recently, he's been publishing lots of articles. One of my favorite people to follow in the space because he has just that right level of toxicity. And I think it's essential right now that we have people with authentic voices. So with that, Mike, welcome to the stage at the Bitcoin Bottom Line.
Oh, thank you, man. I appreciate it. My favorite part really is that you and I have been chatting for quite a while, started back on Clubhouse. So this has been an interesting journey we've been on together.
Yeah, I think there's a really interesting dynamic between all the people that met in Clubhouse, because we developed this sort of voice recognition situation where it's like a long distance relationship. And then all of a sudden you go to BitBlock Boom or the Miami conference or something like that, and you're like, bro, we should do a hug right now.
So, that was the best. Yeah, that really was the best.
The second best thing though was eating spicy Thai soup at BitBlock Boom when it was 95 degrees outside.
Oh my God, I was dying. Do you remember like the whole time? I was like, dude, I can't stop eating, but I am sweating so much.
Well, I think you and I have a lot in common in terms of like exercise physiology, kinesiology, that whole background. Which I think makes you a very organized person. I think of you as a very organized person. How does that, like, what would you say the inspiration to kind of like be systematic with your process and your personal life with that?
Ooh, okay. I'll try and keep it short because that's kind of like a story or a history that goes all the way back. But it really started, so I was in a really dark way, mentally, emotionally, spiritually, when I was around 23, which would be back in 2013. Mm-hmm. And that was the reasoning why I enlisted in the military. I'm sure a lot of people, like your viewers, your whoever is going to be listening to this in the future, yourself, the military is generally a pretty good way to hit the reset button if you're needing one. And it served as a really good reset button. So that helped me kind of reorganize my thoughts by getting back to square one. Mm-hmm. And then actually while I was in basic training during the downtime, which there was a lot of, I was reading Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl. Mm-hmm. And that kind of helped me not find purpose as far as like find purpose with life and everything, but it helped me open my mind to finding purpose, which I think a lot of people don't really give enough credit generally to the population, considering there's a lot of noise in modern society right now. And mm-hmm. then once I got done with basic training and AIT, which is, if I remember the acronym correctly, is Advanced Individual Training, job training for the military, which was down in Fort Rucker, I got back home and I noticed that as soon as I got back into modern society, like normal living, I struggled really, really badly to like actually kind of keep my thoughts and my plans organized. And then while I was at basic training, I kind of did a lot of just psychological searching, trying to figure out, like I was good at school up until high school. And then I got my butt kicked because I didn't know how to study. Mm-hmm. And I determined that the reasoning was that growing up, I learned kind of by osmosis, because my family, my mom and my dad, my sister and I, like we all would hang out and we would watch like educational stuff. Like back when TV wasn't complete junk yet. Like, you know, when MTV was still showing music videos,
right?
We were watching like Animal Planet, Discovery Channel, History Channel. Like I was watching all about World War II and learning about like all that stuff, learning about military tactics from the History Channel, because they would talk about like Hannibal and
different battles, and yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And it fascinated me. And so that kind of like helped me with having just general wonder for everything, like astronomy, physiology, all of it. Right. And that kind of helped me with school, as like I already knew the stuff.
Right.
So I didn't need to study.
So you were like one of those people that would get answers right on Jeopardy, because you had a base knowledge of history and some of these other things.
Children's Jeopardy, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But what I'm saying is, like, you had a wide range of topics that were sort of just in your head floating around. And then yes. It took time to sort of, like, condense that into maybe a little bit more. So I guess one thing that we talk about in sports all the time is, you know, your mind comes through your feet, right? So in basic training, I imagine that you get your ass kicked and you have to run and you have to do all this stuff. And this sort of the physical exertion pushes you to sort of hone your mind because you need to hold on to that one light at the end of the tunnel kind of thing, right? And so there's like a laser beam focus that develops from
that. Yes and no, because part of that I was getting to was after I came back from basic training, after kind of like searching through myself during basic training, mm-hmm. I went and saw a psychiatrist and we determined that I had ADD the whole time. But because of my background of just like soaking up knowledge for fun, it kind of got masked the entire time.
Right.
So then I got onto just a very minor Ritalin. I still use it. I haven't needed to up tolerance or anything, which is apparently a typical problem with the medication. But it is, and I have talked with a lot of my friends and family about this. It terrified me how much just a little bit of Ritalin helped me completely. I described it to my mom, like, imagine all of your thoughts in your mind are just like a cloud of topics and things that whether they interest you or whether they don't interest you, they're just a cloud and they're like up there, up above your head, just floating around. But with ADD, it's like they're up there and then they're constantly reorganizing. But then with Ritalin, it like kind of like helps you produce columns and a hierarchy and like organize everything. It's like, okay, if I want to do this and I got to go this path all the way up. And it scares me because, or it scared me at the time was, because I determined that if I was going to try and go a route without it, I would have to live an extremely constricted lifestyle, which the military could provide, but I hated the military. So,
right. Well, because that's, I guess, the question then is when you got into studying, I think it's kinesiology or something like that, right? Did you do?
Basically exercise science, exercise and movement science is the technical term.
Right. So as an athlete, that was sort of a hobby of mine, the way some people might have a hobby of cooking steaks on the weekend or whatever, right? So in order to figure out how to get my body to function better, you know, from a physical standpoint, I was always trying to find those tiny little, you know, competitive things to get my fastball one more mile an hour, my curveball a little bit more rotation, something like that. So I guess you've taken an academic approach to that, you know, and I think through learning how the body works, as well as your eclectic knowledge, it gives you like a really interesting perspective when I see your tweets about diet and when I see your tweets about, you know, all this other stuff. So the articles that you've been writing, they're wide ranging. You're not just that guy that has the keyboard that keeps hitting C sharp, right? You're kind of playing a song, you're putting all this together. And recently we were at the mining conference in Austin. And we had a really long talk, you know, just hanging out. Really long talk and went everywhere. Literally went all the way to outer space, all the way to inner space. We talked about all these other things. So I guess, do you feel now that how does Bitcoin factor into your thought process in terms of staying, you know, I guess maybe like spiritually organized or mentally organized or whatever you want to call it, to give you that sort of leading light?
Yeah, so this actually goes back to the kinesiology, surprisingly, at least for me, is that so in college when I was finishing up my degree is like really in that the senior year is really when you actually do the exciting stuff and you're actually learning like the cutting edge. But when I finally grasped that improving the neuromuscular connection in your body improves the way that your brain and the neurons and the spinal cord, like by improving your mind body connection, you actually are teaching your spinal column, which is like technically your second brain and your brain itself. You're teaching the whole system to learn better and learn faster. And then by also actually learning, like studying and reading, I could leverage my learning even more because then it's just jacking up that neuroplasticity. And then I actually, was it last year or maybe this year, I read a recent study on neurobiology where they actually mapped out the pathway that explains that when you learn, so if you learn a specific topic, like you learn, like say kinesiology, and you grasp some things on around kinesiology, but then there's another topic that is slightly close, that's relevantly close to it. Your brain will grasp onto that concept a lot easier by nature.
Right.
And that really made a lot of sense and blew my mind. But so like, that's really kind of how it gets to the point, in my opinion, where I understand all this stuff. Cause like with kinesiology, or physiology, and you understand the circulatory system and like the Krebs cycle and the oxidative cycle, and you understand how, well, maybe understand's a big word, because like the Krebs cycle and the oxidative cycle, I still get confused on that because I'm awful at chemistry. But when you understand the system, the mechanism, but the way it works, then you can also understand like general logistics, because that's how like the US economy works. Like without the truckers, you don't, they aren't, they're the blood cells. Like they're the ones that are transporting all the information and all the nutrients. Right. You don't have blood cells going back and forth, then you die. So
let me grab that for a second, because that's something that always made sense to me, because I was very routine oriented when I was playing baseball. I pitched once every 5 days, so I had to prep myself. There was a sort of ramp up in a phase.
Periodization.
Periodization. So I would be trying to like not only periodize for that 5 days, but also for that 6 month season, you know?
Yeah.
And then have this sort of like 6 weeks on, 2 weeks off thing with my weightlifting and stuff like that or whatever.
Yep.
So I was able to build throughout the season and still lift heavy. But then I came up with like a whole thing where I was actually trying to quantitatively rank how hard the outing was itself. So for instance, if it was 95 plus degrees outside when I pitched, how many pitches did I throw per inning? You know, how many pitches did I throw above this velocity? How many fastballs did I throw as a result of that? How much recovery would I need? How much leg work or body work or massage work or whatever would I need? And I tried to kind of quantify that to the point where like my last year, I really had it dialed. It's one of those things that they say, don't you wish you knew this when you were a kid? Because if I would have had that when I was like 20, you know, maybe I might have played for another 4 or 5 years or something like that, or just played at a higher level for a couple more years. But the body is a sort of, it's a great teacher, right? And it's a great, it's a great microcosm for things. And I explain spinal, like the way the spine works, as a bridge, right? You have the left side and the right side, and you have like a sort of long column. So I say it's like the Golden Gate Bridge. If you have one, you know, one of those cables snaps, the thing's going to lurch to the side, right?
Yeah.
So in using that just to talk about logistics, then, you know, we have this whole supply chain, right? Globally, we have cheap labor offshore. We have expensive labor onshore. We have money going in every direction, right? We have internet commerce, deliveries, drone warehouses, payment structures, ships, trains, you know, and then trucks, and then people unloading at the docks at all those different, you know, various things.
And then all the supporting systems that go along with it.
Right. So the funny thing is, obviously, this is the Bitcoin bottom line. So we talk about Bitcoin, obviously. So you had this really wide, like a very eclectic knowledge base to draw from. And having been in the military and gone to college and physiology and all these other things going everywhere, where did Bitcoin kind of form for you? Like when in this process were you like, oh, Bitcoin's a thing, and then you see the deeper truth behind it? Because you seem to be very exploratory, very curious. It's like I said, because your articles are going on different topics, I know that you want to know all the stuff around it. So,
So that the Bitcoin thread started as I was mobilizing to deploy to the Middle East. And the reason was that, so if you've seen any of the other podcasts I've done, I mentioned how my mother was like my mentor. I learned a lot from my dad. My dad taught me a lot of really good things, but my mom was largely the mentor. She was the one that went to college in the family. She had an executive position. Like there was just a lot more that I wanted to learn and understand from her point of view. And when it came to the point of preparing to deploy, that was about to be like the first time that I had ever had access to like basically a salary. And I knew that also being over there, it was going to like the income isn't taxed when you're deployed, depending on the area that you go to. And I told her, I was like, this is going to be the most money I've ever had. I'm not trying to just like burn it like some idiot. Mm-hmm. So I told her, and I came to the conclusion that I was like, I want to be wealthy when I grow up. I have to find a way to make my money like work for me. And so I started looking into investment theory and all that other stuff. And one of the ones that sticks through all of the great investors is you have to put your money where the market's going to go before the market goes there and before the market realizes it.
Right.
And that was spring of 17, right. Which I think I'm pretty sure Bitcoin is like $1,000. Like it broke a headline and like it was everywhere. And I was like, oh, this is interesting. Because just prior to that, the only time I'd heard about Bitcoin was people were power leveling RuneScape accounts and selling them for Bitcoin.
Yeah.
So I saw the headline. I was like, oh, this is cool. I cataloged it, didn't think about it. And then as I was getting closer to heading down to Fort Hood, I saw another headline, which would have been like July, August of 2017, and Bitcoin broke $4,000. And I was like, okay, this thing just quadrupled in 4 months. Now I need to look at this because people are buying it up to this price for some reason.
Right.
And so then I ended up spending basically my entire deployment being like the Bitcoin guy within my unit. And I wouldn't shut up about it because so one of the things about the Army specifically is like hurry up and wait. Mm-hmm. And we are an aviation support battalion. So we got to where we were going and there was no work. Mm. So it was like, you're sitting in the middle of a desert, it's 130 degrees, there's nothing to do. So I was like, okay, well, and this is when Pomp and Marty Bennett both just started their podcasts. Because I came to Twitter because after I was Googling all the time, it kept taking me back to Twitter for people that are talking about it. I'm like, okay, I guess I got to be here because this is the only place that people are talking about it. Because I hate Reddit. Like, I'm sorry. People keep telling me to use Reddit. Like, I can't stand it. Like, I just, like, and so, and very much like Twitter is the arena of thought, which I love. Mm-hmm. So that's where I would spend somewhere between 4 to 12 hours a day just consuming Bitcoin content and trying to understand because like there's Austrian economics, there's like just so many different concepts that aren't actively taught in school. So right. I had to really dedicate a lot of effort and like focus, particularly to Bitcoin. So,
yeah, I think, you know, along those lines, coming in when you did and when I did, because I think I was probably a couple months behind you, there was so much content that was out there. You know, you could see the Antonopoulos YouTube videos and these types of things, and you could kind of catch up, right? Because at $1,000, $3,000, $4,000, like Bitcoin was still a really unproven asset at that point, you know, because a lot of people were like, what's the whole deal? For me, it was really the scarcity thing. Once I got to the scarcity thing, I really like that's what really clicked. And I was like, oh, it's better than gold. Cause I was like a fear investor, you know, in the 08, 09 cycle, I was like buying gold and buying bullets and stuff like that. Cause I was like, man, it's what we're going to need if the world falls apart. Cause you know, we didn't know what was going to happen, that unpredictability. And so Bitcoin for me was really like interesting, but I guess the question I have for you is, on it from an international standpoint, right? So then you're traveling, you're in a theater or whatever, you're in the desert out there. How did that educate you from an osmosis practical standpoint on sort of, you know, America and geopolitics and things like that? Like, because I would assume that growing up where you'd grown up, that you hadn't really, you'd never been to, you know, Africa, you'd never been to Germany, you'd never been to Russia or Japan or any of these places, right? So like all of a sudden now you're thrust into this forward facing base and like you're confronted with the reality at that point, right? So it's like that's a real I guess a wake-up call in a way.
I guess wake-up call would probably be the closest to it, but there wasn't necessarily like a string of like fear,
right?
But it was largely going through those, like going internationally for the first time and then realizing, oh, there's a foreign exchange of currencies. And I was like, I did not know that the US dollar is constantly in flux against all the other dollars. I was like, okay, I didn't know that. Like I had no reason to know that being never leaving the US, but it totally makes sense. Mm-hmm. And then on top of that, one of the really big, like the one that really ignited the geopolitical thing for me was when, so I had a way of, at the time I was smoking cigarettes in the Army, mm-hmm. not a huge proud point, but I learned that by smoking cigarettes with particular groups, I could learn a lot. because when people are like smoking, it's the same thing as when people are drinking. Like they like inhibitions lower, and then you start to really learn a lot of stuff. And in those kinds of conversations, I'm not going to talk about who I was talking with, but I learned that one of the bases that we were like working on was designed to be torn down in a 24-hour period, but had become more permanent, particularly because it was sitting on top of an oil reserve.
Ah.
And I was like, oh, that's sinister. I was like, okay, yeah. that's sinister. It's really clever. I'm like, okay, like that really kind of was just like that was the wake up call. Like the,
aha. That was the curtain. The curtain finally opens up and you're like, whoa, there's Dr. Oz. Right.
Yeah.
So, okay. Obviously, you know, all this stuff, wide ranging. I want to get into some of the stuff that you've written about recently. Okay. One of the things that we get hammered on for being Bitcoiners all the time is energy, right? You have the Green New Deal people constantly in the tech industry constantly saying, oh, there's a better way to do this. You guys are wasting energy, all this other stuff. You've gone down the rabbit hole on Bitcoin's energy use, you know?
Yeah.
And you've put a lot of good thought into this. So what's the sort of conclusion on this or this article that you wrote for Bitcoin Magazine?
So we could talk first about the Microsoft one, because I had written one, I think it was this last summer. I've completely lost like all track of time being in Bitcoin and then all of these geopolitical dynamics the last couple of years. Mm-hmm. But I started off like really kind of approaching the energy usage argument when Senator Warren really started kind of like poking the bear as far as like the Bitcoin community, like making really inflammatory claims, like the not based in
70 days of a typical home use or something like that.
Something like that. And like, I can understand opinionated, like emotionally charged opinions and all that stuff. But when there isn't data behind it, I'm like, especially if you're a senator, you kind of need to like walk it back a little bit. Like maybe you should make sure you understand. Cause like, you understand, like within the Bitcoin community, if I say something that is not backed by fact of reality on Twitter and I piss off the wrong people, like I'm going to get like socially just burned at the stake because like,
you're going to get ratioed hard. And I remember that because like, I think this is something that Bitcoin has done for me a lot is that it's forced me to step out, you know, and put my opinions out there a little bit more. When I think there's a sort of moral obligation to get things right and people are getting it wrong, I feel like it's sort of our moral obligation to correct them, right?
Yeah.
And there are people that maybe do this a little bit less professionally than others, obviously, because I'm doing a lot of this sort of government interaction now where I'm trying to like orange pill people in DC. I'm having to use a little bit cleaner language, for instance, and the memes can't be vulgar. So,
which is really hard.
Right. But you get into this thing, you know, and I'm taking us off track. I want to get back to it.
No, you're fine.
But you get into this thing where you're not scared to tweet back to Senator Warren to be like, actually, Senator, you are incorrect.
Like you're incorrect in a lot of ways.
Yeah, you're incorrect. And we need to deal with that because it's not fair, you know? And I think that's where like people like yourself that have really been a part of the government machine, right? You've seen the underbelly, right, of the beast, this thing that like people like Gladstein have written about. And now here you are, you know, on the same side that he's on to say that, hey, like energy use is not the problem here. Right. So there's lots of companies use energy, like lots of people use energy. Like, why is that immoral suddenly to use energy? Right. So,
man, if like back on the energy topic,
teeing it up for you,
if people understood how much energy the U.S. military wastes just on bases alone, like without vehicle use. I think that like what's the quote from Henry Ford? If people understood the financial system, they would be in the streets by like tomorrow morning.
Yes.
Like I think that people would probably be in the streets by tomorrow morning if they understood just how much diesel fuel the U.S. Army burns through. And that's just the U.S. Army. That's not the Navy. And like ships are not efficient.
Right.
And that's not including JP-8, which is jet fuel. Like,
right.
I mean, that's a little bit more efficient. But yeah, anyway, back digressing. the one article that I wrote particularly around Microsoft, because, and the reason I picked Microsoft is because, like, when we're talking about all this energy moralization, especially from our favorite senator, nobody talks about, like, the household names. Like, nobody talks about Samsung or Google or
Apple.
Apple. Right. And then, so I was like, okay, like, and like, but especially with recent developments, I was like, all right, I'm going to look at Microsoft and just see what their numbers look like. Mm-hmm. And I ended up breaking it down to, so I looked at a 2019 report because I couldn't find reports for employment and energy usage for anything like more recent. Probably because that's proprietary knowledge. So when I looked at this and I ran the numbers, there was, I've got it right here. They had 144,000 employees in 2019. And I believe, if this is the math, they used up 9.2 million megawatts for the year. And so I divided that, just like really basic, like arithmetic. And you divide that out, and that comes to 63.9 megawatts per employee. And the problem people don't understand, like probably don't understand like how much that is, that according to the U.S. Energy Information Administration, the average household consumes only 10,000 kilowatts per year at 893 kilowatts per month. Mm-hmm. So each one of these employees at Microsoft was consuming approximately 4,000 households worth of energy consumption per year.
Right. That's beautiful math right there, because people all the time, because like basically the Bitcoin network, the hypothesized number, I think at last guess, was about 100 terawatts, right?
Okay.
Yeah. So 100 terawatts. And at 100 terawatts, it's moving $15 trillion worth of value, right? Last year, Bitcoin moved 15.1 or 15.01 or something like that, trillion dollars. So if you think about it, that effectively means the network itself is worth $15 trillion. I mean, really, forget the market cap, because you have to, you know, that trust cycle of holding all those transactions, keeping all those transactions safe. So the Bitcoin mining thing, in terms of the energy usage, it's like, okay, well, you know, there's a lot of value. There's $2.9 million per second of value transacted on the Bitcoin network, right? Yeah. And you think about that per second. So how many seconds are there in a year, right? And how many, if you break all that down to users and all this other stuff, I would say Bitcoin's morally justified at that point by producing a very high value for the energy use, which, by the way, the energy use is, you know, always thrown up there against countries, but like not every country.
And they're always small countries.
Yeah. It's like, oh, well, you know, yeah, Argentina. It's like, well, what's Argentina's GDP and what are they contributing to the global economy, right? Like, when's the last invention to come out of Argentina?
Well, you don't hear people comparing the energy cost or the energy consumption of Texas versus Delaware.
Right.
Like,
yeah,
like,
this is different animal.
Why are people not like acknowledging these completely just, ugh.
Yeah.
This is the stuff that frustrates me.
Right. Right. And I think, and it's good, because I think that pressure, that friction, it brings the best out of us as workers, as someone that's maybe pushed himself really hard to study and physically, like obviously you push yourself really hard. So one of the hardest things that anybody has conceptually to do is to really like break down the reality and understand that life is not supermarkets for everybody. Right.
Yeah.
So supermarkets are a sort of mirage where you go there and magically everything's cut to the right size. It's in these cute little containers and all that other stuff. That's not reality, though. Reality is somebody's performing either mechanized or backbreaking labor on a very big parcel of land. And then there's people that are aggregating all those food products into those aisles. One of the big movements right now for like the really, I would say like my hero Bitcoiners, guys like Untapped Growth, they're talking about regenerative farming. You did another thing about Bitcoin and farming and how that's an important part of the cycle for just the world economy and American economy. Why do farmers need Bitcoin, and why does America need regenerative farming as a thought process, as opposed to, you know, like what do we need out of this? What's something that Bitcoiners maybe haven't considered before?
So the reason I make the argument for farmers is because, so this is another thing where like Bitcoin and my deployment and farming like really overlapped, was because my unit is based, like, it's not technically based out of Iowa, but the headquarters is like, one of the headquarters is in Iowa. Like, when there's a lot of technicalities to that, because of the nature of the National Guard, but a lot of my unit, they were farmers. So they also like a lot, and I found out that a lot of them were actually trading Bitcoin, like while we were overseas, because one thing I didn't understand as far as like farmers, like experience and knowledge and how actually intelligent they are versus like what people like perceive of them,
right,
is that because of the nature of that agriculture has been in since really the 70s, when Earl Butts like gave the whole like farmers need to either get big or get out, where they're trying to like really push the industrialized like cover crop mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Ever since then, really, farmers have been just getting slowly and slowly squeezed, not just by inflation, but because of subsidies. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, like, so they've got inflation over here squeezing mm-hmm. them a little bit every year. Then they've got subsidies, which are like marketed as helping them, but mm-hmm. it's debt. And so they're kind of like, farmers are kind of falling prey to the same system as like the economic hitman like situation.
Mm-hmm.
And then while that's happening, which I didn't realize until I had my discussions with Texas Slim.
Mm-hmm.
And he talked about, Texas Slim and Untapped Growth. I had talked with both of them. Untapped has been super busy, so I haven't really been chatting with him lately. But one thing that I wasn't aware of was that what fertilizers were actually doing to the soil. This is another one of those kind of like mass formation psychosis that everybody likes to talk about now that Jordan Peterson made it popular. So people are like, a lot of people kind of believe that like that nitrogen fertilizers are super necessary to like really grow anything. And okay. The only reason that's the case is that since like the 30s, well, technically since forever, like going all the way back to the Roman Empire, industrialized farming practices, like while they've gotten better, because of the nature that they've gotten better, is that they're more rapidly sapping the nutrients out of the soil. Mm-hmm. And when I understood that, then it clicked for me as far as like going back to nutrients and physiology, because mm-hmm. One of the other writers for Texas Slim, he blew my mind when he brought up a point from, I think it was Gabe Brown was the author. Gabe Brown in his book wrote that today, which I don't remember how recent the book was. Maybe it was 2017. This is in the last couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
So you and me, like the oranges and the bananas and the apples that we go grab from the supermarket right now,
mm-hmm.
compared to the fruit that our grandparents were eating, we have about 12.5% the nutrient density as what our grandparents were eating. And that was when it really like, that was like a nuclear bomb in my mind went off. I'm like, holy crap. No wonder we have all these chronic metabolic diseases that are like mixing with the fact that like the job market isn't as labor intensive as it was 50, 60 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm like, and that goes back to like my understanding of multiple different like problems and kind of right. just bringing them all together.
So we really have this issue globally now because people are mechanizing so many things. They're looking for the easy way out. Their expectations of how much they're going to work are less, right? Because technology fixes everything. But at the same time, we're not regenerating nutritionally because we've stripped the soil of the good stuff, and the stuff yes. that we're putting back in it, the fertilizer, is effectively just it's just a get rich quick scheme. In a lot yeah. of ways, right? You can't sustain that cycle if you're not putting the worms back in the soil and all this other stuff, right?
So the thing about that too, which goes back to why farmers need Bitcoin, but really quickly, is that what I also didn't understand was like, we talk about like the Roman Empire collapse or like the French Revolution.
Yeah.
Both of those, like they really reached the tipping point of where the public finally had enough mm-hmm. when the state could no longer provide free bread.
Ah.
Because they had pushed the farmers to such extremes that they degraded the soil so bad that they just couldn't produce anymore.
Right.
And the reason that farmers need Bitcoin, going back to that, is that just as far as like just financial security. Mm-hmm. And the reason I argue for that is along the same lines as what one of the other articles I wrote about, where I talked about why pensions need Bitcoin. I basically argue the same point, but from different points of view, is that you guys, like these guys are largely relying on some form of like money management or investment, whether it's farmers or pensioners. Like there's a huge reliance on either assets and or treasuries, which include bonds, notes, and treasuries.
Yep.
And people don't understand that what's going on in the bond market right now, which I understand is a very complex and very confusing world. It took me a while to this is where Clubhouse comes in too, because I was getting up at like 4 a.m. and learning from like Preston Pish and Jay Gould directly, like talking to them. And once I understood that and understood that the stock market and all these assets are largely reliant on the bond market, which is just government debt, mm-hmm. I was like, okay, so the bond market is going a certain type of way that we think we understand where it's going, which we also kind of think we understand where the stock market's going because of where the bond market's going. And if that's the case, if the US dollar really is on its way, like spiraling down, which we would all argue it is because it's a fiat dollar and fiat dollars don't live very long, then farmers need Bitcoin more than any of us. Because if the farmers don't have a financial vehicle with which to continue producing food,
we have no food.
Then we have no food. And at that point, then it doesn't matter if the truckers are there or not, because the truckers aren't going to have food to transport anyway.
Right, right. And I live in a farming community. So like bumper stickers in my area, my job depends on ag. That's an actual bumper sticker. Dams mean water for farmers, right? We need
water. A&F, America Needs Farmers. Yep.
Yeah, exactly. All that stuff. So I, you know, growing up in the city, living in like the sort of Los Angeles area or something like that, and being Mr., you know, baseball player guy for a long time, I didn't really interact with a lot of farmers, even though I lived in Texas for a long time, because I lived like downtown Dallas. But now that I live in Fresno, my clients are farmers. They'll come in and I have like a citrus guy, and he comes in, we shoot the shit. We talk about what's going on. You know, I would ask like funny questions like, hey, why do those trees have bags over them? You know, he's like, oh, because we don't want bees from somebody else's farm to pollinate our trees. Yep. So we have a proprietary, like, you know, brand based on the genetics of the everything else like that. So I've had a lot of chances to like learn in the last 5 years through osmosis. They're going out to these farms and like, you know, I do the John Deere tour and drive around and, you know, pick peaches off the trees and stuff like that. And it's been great. It's been really big for me. So when I met Untapped Growth a couple months ago, I guess, it really kind of spun up a new idea in my head. And it was based on this principle, which is that, you know, farmers are like way, way low time preference, because they're planting a tree. They've got to wait 6 or 7 years for that tree to really bear the fruit, right? And that's a real investment. That's a time horizon that a lot of people don't understand. And a lot of Bitcoin people, when they get into it, there's like, they see these, all these numbers, charts up and down, you know, like horoscope for virgins, there's like lines everywhere and they get all excited. They get all happy. And when farmers get into Bitcoin, they're thinking, hey, how can I hand this stuff to my kids? You know, and it's a completely different personality mix. It's a completely different set of questions. When I'm orange pilling, you know, the 60-year-old, very wealthy farmer guy, he's been through a lot of up and down cycles in that, you know, 50 years of being adjacent.
And and along that same line, like they have to strategize for if the worst happens.
Yeah. They have to get it right so that they don't bonk, you know what I mean? And they don't get liquidated, because effectively farming is like trading with leverage. You know, you're like, you're like 30-year levered long on your, on your pasture, right? Or 30-year levered long on your cattle herd or something like that. Right. So it's like really like a lot different. And I think I really identify with that as a Bitcoiner, because it's sort of like the way that I want to be a Bitcoiner. I don't want to be a Bitcoiner that's like day trading and stuff like that. That's how I originally got into it. And that wears you out. It's not a high quality life.
Oh, it's exhausting.
And it also doesn't feel like you're necessarily doing like the right thing. Like you want to think that you're doing this like moral, like, yeah, I'm hodling Bitcoin. I'm like, I'm making the network stronger. I'm mining, whatever.
This goes back to man's search for meaning from Viktor Frankl.
Right, right. And I think you have to have that meaning in all the things that you do, whether it's your diet, you have to have a reason for eating the way you eat, working out the way you work out, a reason to. And when you have a true purpose on a spiritual level on the inside, and we talked about this back in Texas, it really gives you like a beacon. And then that beacon sort of like helps you swim through the fog or the forest or whatever else, and sort of, you know, dodge right and left and get around these weird like obstacles that we have in life. One of those obstacles, I think, for the Bitcoin network, obviously we've talked about the FUD, having a low time preference with farmers and stuff like that. But now Bitcoin being an international thing, right? I think we're seeing this now with Canada. We're seeing this with all these other things. There's all these moving pieces now. And effectively every country has at least one Senator Karen. But it's very interesting to see how Bitcoiners are getting all happy when a country like Russia says, hey, we're going to allow Bitcoin mining. or we're going to allow Bitcoin this or that or whatever. For me as a miner, right, I go on Compass's website and it's like one of the places you can host a miner is in some Scrabble letters put together place in Russia on some sort of dam. I don't know what the deal is there. And I'm sitting there thinking, I don't think I got the balls to host a Bitcoin miner in Russia. You know, obviously it's a very volatile situation, but this is a couple months ago. And now obviously this is coming to a head. So I'm just like, I guess for you, like having the sort of the inside the belly of the beast perspective of being an ex-government guy, and then now as you're just keep continuing to go deeper in the rabbit hole. Yep. How do you feel like Russia and Bitcoin and America and Bitcoin, how do you see all this developing right now? Because I'm obviously dealing with people in DC, but I think you have the really 30,000 foot view on this. It's interesting.
Yeah. So, and I know we're coming tight on time, but we have like, I kind of, there's a little bit of a grace period here. We have like 20 more minutes, so we can rant some more. So when it comes to the way I'm seeing the whole Russia thing, so we have to kind of like wheel back to all the way to the beginning, which would be like El Salvador.
Okay.
Being the first country to like, you know, we're pro Bitcoin, like bring all the Bitcoin you want, like Bitcoiners come to us and all this stuff. So the way I kind of analogize that or use an allegory or whatever you want to talk about, the way I analogize that is like, so if we take like groupthink or like mass formation psychosis, like just groupthink in general, or like the mob, when the first person steps away from the group and says that, you know, I'm going to do something different. Usually the group ostracizes and fights back and says, you're wrong. You're an idiot, which, you know, the World Economic Forum, the IMF, they've been doing.
Yeah.
But what really changes the tide, what really shifts the tide is when somebody with social authority joins them. And this, I'm not saying that Russia's good. I don't think Putin's good necessarily, but by Russia stepping out and joining El Salvador, then it gave actual credence and wealth to the point that El Salvador is making.
Right.
And the big thing here was, I think it was it February 4th? Maybe I'm off by a few days, when Russia, when the Kremlin like put out the letter stating that they're basically going to ally with China.
Mm-hmm. On the oil deal. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and it's not just the oil deal. So,
but they were going to do sovereign transactions without using the dollar, and they were going to kind of create their own trade pipeline.
Because Russia a couple weeks ago or a couple months ago, I've completely lost track of time. They had already mentioned that they've been wheeling back like their use of the like their reliance on the dollar as far as markets goes.
Right.
And then so one of the interesting things that's going on right now with Russia is that, so China has been posturing similar to Russia in the sense of like really being aggressive for the last couple of years, mm-hmm. particularly like on the border of India, like they were getting into it up in the Himalayas, if you remember that. And then
geographical skirmishes.
Yeah. And they've been applying pressure. Like they already like absorbed Hong Kong. They're looking at Taiwan now. One of the interesting things with China is that not only with the Evergrande situation, where their residential market is completely basically screwed because entire generations have been using real estate as investment, mm-hmm. which you're going to run into some issues when you run out of land.
People to occupy the high rises, right?
Yeah. And then like that comes back to like their whole debt market, where they're just using debt to have these development projects that weren't like actually going to be, people weren't actually trying to live in them, so they're just building all these buildings, like whatever. But the interesting thing is that with that whole kind of clusterfuck of problems within China, mm-hmm. There's specific provinces that like specialize, and particularly the Guangdong mm-hmm. province is like a huge source of hydroelectric power, and they've been experiencing a drought. So that means that one of the major sources of energy in China isn't producing energy, which is also going to affect the manufacturing and the trade, which the mm-hmm. whole world heavily relies on, specifically the US and the EU through Germany.
Right.
So what Russia's got is they've got the oil and gas. Like mm-hmm. they like they they're not the guy for oil and gas, but they're basically the guy for oil and gas, especially again for the EU and for a large part of the United States.
And as Germany votes to take their nuclear reactors offline, now they're being, so you have this web of not even control, but just a sort of like reliance.
More right? like opportunity.
Yeah, but I mean, like somebody said this, somebody, some Harvard economist just came out with a thing saying that Russia is basically just a gas station and that we shouldn't take them seriously.
It's a really oversimplification.
Right, but here's the thing. If you're out of gas, you need a gas station. And there's a lot of countries that don't have nat gas, and it's still wintertime, which means it's still freezing, which means you need heat. And so it's one of those things that, like, you know, people will trade a Rolex for a jacket if they're freezing. Yeah. And I think that's where countries like Russia, which obviously chess is a big game there, right? So they play this 4D chess match where they say, oh, we have this resource that you need. It might only be, you know, it might be the only thing that you need, but it is a valuable thing because you need it. Not necessarily if you don't need it, right? If you have a ton of gas, like Saudi Arabia doesn't need Russian oil, right? But Germany does, right?
Yep.
And maybe Austria does, maybe the you know, the Norway and the Scandinavian countries do or whatever. So that's really been the sort of, I would say, if, for lack of a better term, it's been the lubrication between all the functional economic progress that Russia has made, sort of transitioning into, you know, from a full-on communist state into like oligarchs and power brokers and all this other interaction.
Well, and the icing on the cake for that whole situation, we just talked about farming and fertilizer. Russia and China are so they like their exports are some of the biggest bases for fertilizer in the world, like particularly the EU and the US,
right?
Like ammonium nitrate, which is Russia, and then I think China was potash and or phosphorus. I can be wrong. I'm probably wrong on that, but like when you have all of that going on with oil and gas and energy in general, and how China, like really Russia, is like the kind of like centerpiece for all of it, or the keystone for the situation. And then like again, you've got the nuclear just unwinding all over the place in the US and Germany and like France and all these other places.
Yeah.
And then on top of that, you're squelching off or choking off one of the biggest sources for general fertilizer for your farming abroad and domestically. Like
it's a salad bar of bad elements that are kind of tying together right now.
And like, because like the farming and the fertilizer thing is like that last little piece, like the straw on the camel's back. And it's just like, then you really understand how we're not like all this globalization and just in time, like product matching and all this stuff has really made the really kind of like the entire global economy extremely weak.
Yeah. Well, I would take it back. I'll tie it back to the body again. If you burn the candle at both ends, you run out of resources very fast. But if you're not regenerating through sleep, nutrition, hydration, all that stuff, which is the same thing that the planet needs when you're growing things in it, right?
You need nitrogen. Natural ebbs and flows.
Yeah, exactly. And I think sometimes what happens is we, as technologically savvy people in a first world country like America, we sort of like dismiss the difficulties of these things because we say, oh, that's all the way over there.
And it doesn't matter.
I have an app that's going to fix this. And it's like, well, here's the thing. Like, you know, I think I do this thought experiment sometimes. I was with somebody the other day and I said, how many people in this restaurant do you think could start a fire with their bare hands? Like, how many people do you think could really survive like a week-long blackout in their city, you know? And you start thinking of all these issues because we're messing with the energy mixes and the energy sources and we're pushing things around. You see what happened in Texas. The same thing happens in Europe all the time. There's issues with that, right? And I think Russia, in my mind, sees Bitcoin as an opportunity to acquire another asset. The same way I see it as a way to acquire an asset, they see it. Because they see that it's something that's scarce, like oil, right? And other people want it like natural gas, and it's easily transported like natural gas or oil. And it's something that you can use to create these really thick bandwidth bridges, you know, with different countries and effectively force people to come to your table. And I think from a diplomatic standpoint, that's the most interesting thing about the developments in the last 3 or 4 months. It still doesn't make me feel safe about having Russia as a Bitcoin country per se.
Yeah.
Right? It's not like I would consider moving to St. Petersburg or one of these places. No. But I think this goes back to the things that we have been telling the senators and the congressmen for years, which is America needs to get on the Bitcoin train because other countries will. Will happen. It's already starting to happen. And if we don't get to be one of those top people at the table, then forget the G7, forget the G20. Yeah. There's going to be a B7 and a B20, right, of the top Bitcoin countries. And if Bitcoin does wick straight up because there's some sort of mass adoption, you know, fabric stretching over the whole world, and the value of Bitcoin, you know, hyperinflates because dollars crash, because people need it, because people want it, because there's more people using it. It's like, at some point now, I mean, Russia has sort of solidified, hey, we're going to be Bitcoin adjacent, friendly. Maybe you have to, something came out today, you have to pass a test, otherwise you won't be able to buy more than $650 of it. I don't know what that is compared to the living wage in Russia, so maybe it's relative to like our $10,000 carry rule or whatever. But I do think it's interesting, and I think that we need to take a very aggressive stance as a country to like really open the fire hose up and get all the Bitcoin we can into America and make America really centric towards the Bitcoin movement.
Yeah, and then to like really drive home the relevancy to ourselves in the U.S. is that Russia, Putin also acknowledged the fact that incorporating Bitcoin mining into the grid strengthens the grid. Right. Because it gives the energy producers a way to monetize closer to 99.9% of their time rather than now, where it's all demand focused. They make their money during the highest points of demand in the day or the evening. And then when it goes down, they have to like basically curb back or wheel back a lot of their production to just match demand, where they could just be running as close to 100% as possible, monetize that excess time, then use that revenue or that profit to, you know, either improve their maintenance practices or like get better tech or just put it on the balance sheet and wait for like a time where they need it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really, I would say there's dark clouds forming on the horizon in a lot of ways, but when you have those hopeful stories like El Salvador, like some of these other Latin American countries that might be bringing it on board, whether that's Paraguay or Ecuador, any of these other places. Yeah. I think when we used to talk about this in baseball, this is really funny terminology. When you would be bludgeoning a team so badly that like you were just happy to go, like you're like, oh man, we're going to score 20 runs today off these guys. We used to joke that there was going to be a fight at the bat rack because everybody wanted to run and grab a bat and just go hit because there was going to be just like so many meatballs.
It's free game.
Yeah, it's free game at that point. And I think we're still not at that point yet in terms of the diplomatic solutions for Bitcoin. Yeah. I think at some point we'll be there. I think you see some states that are taking advantage of the opportunities. They're recruiting businesses to Texas and places like that. Wyoming obviously is leading the charge in so many ways, legislatively, and Ohio's in the mix now. They're recruiting companies and people and all this other stuff. I really hope that by the time you and I see each other at Bitcoin Miami or at BitBlock Boom or any of these other conferences, that we have better news. And that the light from these volcanoes is sort of like splitting the clouds a little bit. You know, that's what I really hope.
I'm confident we will. I don't, cause a lot of people talk smack about our politicians, but they're not like ignorant or dumb. They're just busy.
They're busy. Yeah, they are. They are busy. And it was funny because I saw a letter recently or a tweet thread actually from a senator saying, hey, just so you guys know, like there's this many people on the Financial Services Committee. They all have staff that work for them. If you guys get to the staff, that's a more efficient way than just email blasting. So, or tweet blasting people, right? And I think that, so to close on this is a favorite topic of, I think, both of ours. You know, you and I think are both naturally a little bit more shy in social circumstances and maybe want to have those one-on-one
guarded.
Yeah, you want to have those one-on-one deep conversations, and Twitter gives you that chance to sort of like put those things out there. Writing articles and essays gives you that chance.
Yeah.
How do you balance out, you know, having an audience, right, and having a product, meaning like your mental process and putting it all out there? How do you balance that out with like seeing the other people that maybe have more followers but are maybe engagement farming a little bit? And how do you keep your integrity as a sort of someone that's not trying to be a hero, someone that's not trying to break the news? Because I feel like I get like idiot shivers sometimes with half the Bitcoin celebrity people, you know what I mean? And it kind of bothers me. Even though like I've been a baseball celebrity and stuff like that, I don't think I'm there with the Bitcoin thing really. And I think maybe you and I are on the same journey because we got in around the same time. You're producing things now. You have a you want to do it. You want to put it out there. But also, you're not like, hey, everybody, look at me, like headlines, you know. So how do you balance that out as a Bitcoiner?
Well, so that's first of all, that's kind of like a daily thing, to be completely honest, because like you'll see like engagement farming tweets from a particular individual that you might know in person, and there's a likelihood you'll get frustrated that they have a massive following and they're saying something like, you know, that's possibly stupid, and it frustrates you, which sometimes it does for me. And then like, I'll have like that kind of like that tinge of the, like in the back of my head of wanting to really just like go in on them. But at the same time, like, I don't want to be known for that kind of toxicity. Like, I don't want to be that person. I don't want, like, I just want to be who I am, where I'm like, I welcome people to push back on me when I'm wrong. Like, I want that to happen. Yeah. But at the same time, when it's someone who has 50, 100,000 or like 300,000 followers, adding my voice to the flood of people that I know are likely going to be doing, like having the same reaction as myself, it's not necessary.
Yeah.
And then at the same time, I also take measures with all of my like social media to really limit what kinds of notifications I get from people. Like, I only want on Twitter, I have my notifications set to, I only get particular notifications from people that I'm following, because I'm following people because I respect them and I value their point of view on things. And then that, like, that really helps. And then I also keep my phone on do not disturb 99.9% of the time.
Yeah. I think it's interesting, because like when Pete Rizzo and I met for the first time, we were talking about stuff. He was talking about the different cycles and the different people that come in at each cycle, and how
he's a really wise individual.
Yeah, he's like the Bitcoin historian, right? In a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And he said, you know, this whole like geopolitics and macro sort of like perspective, like the Preston Pish kind of, you know, bond market and correlations and all that stuff. He's like, that's all new. He's like, initially it wasn't about that at all. And it's interesting to see how I think sometimes the public perception of Bitcoiners is really still who started Bitcoin, and it's not really who's in Bitcoin now. Because I think it's effectively mainstream to talk about Bitcoin as an investment, you know, to the point that they're talking about on CNBC and stuff like that. So it's effectively arrived as an asset class. But it really is interesting to see how people treat it and how they're how they attach themselves to the narrative. You know,
and that helps with the wisdom too, because Bitcoin's something different to everybody.
Right. Yeah, it's the I like to say it's the octopus. It's got arms going in 8 directions, so you can really kind of latch on to part of that. But eventually those little suckers get you and they roll you back in, and you get touched by all the other things too. And it scars you in a way that makes you tougher, and you know, provides you that pressure and that friction that gives you like the sort of survival instinct. So well, I think Mike, we've literally trotted the globe today on Bitcoin. So I appreciate your time. I look forward to reading more of your articles, digging in deeper with you while we're shitposting on Twitter and putting good memes out there.
Absolutely.
So I just want to say thanks. I look forward to seeing you, I guess, pretty soon in Miami, hopefully.
Yep.
And do you know the next couple articles that you're working on for Bitcoin Magazine, and where can people follow you?
People can follow me at Twitter. It's the with 2 E's Mike Hobart. It sounds really, really ostentatious or narcissistic, but it was the only way that helped me stand out a little bit with my name and not using a NIM, because using a NIM, like, it makes it harder for people to trust you if you don't use like a legitimate name. And other than that, as far as articles I'm working on, I've got probably, I think, half a dozen that haven't been published yet. And then I'm working on something where I'm looking at the law by Frederick Bastiat and talking about like what Bitcoin law would represent. And then I'm looking at some stuff around Afghanistan and what happened there, particularly with how the US stole the Afghanistan like World Bank funds, and they were going to distribute them like what Canada did. Which I think a lot of us would agree is a problem.
Yes.
And then I've got some stuff around health that I'm working on. And then this morning I started a personal project looking into Klaus Schwab.
All right. So. So we got a full lineup coming in the next couple months. So I guess that's good. Yep. All right. Well, I think that wraps it up for the Bitcoin Bottom Line. CJ Wilson joined by Mike Hobart. As always, none of the opinions represent financial advice. Do your own research. And I will see you online and see you on the Bitcoin blockchain.
Absolutely, man. See ya.